You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 21st, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hola.
And Evan Bernstein.
Well, hello, hello, hello. And July 21, 1955... gentleman by the name of Ian Donald, who is a British physician. He made his first investigation of the use of ultrasound in medical diagnosis.
Ooh.
And the rest is history.
And a new standard technique in medicine was born.
That goes back to 55, huh? That's a long, longer than I thought.
55.
They had sound back then?
Right?
Not just sound, Bob. Ultrasound.
Ultrasound.
And the world was black and white then. Didn't become color till about 1962.
Ultrasound is incredibly useful in so many different ways. I mean, it's, you know, most widely known as the thing that pregnant women get to see an image of their baby or whatever. But, I mean, they use it on all sorts of exams to take a look at internal organs and the health of those organs. It's awesome.
What Dr. Donald did in 1955 is he used sonar, effectively a device that creates sonar, put it up against the body of a person to figure out that this person had a ovarian cyst, whereas this woman was going to other doctors and they were diagnosing her with stomach cancer. It was stomach cancer, and it was, you know, inoperable stomach cancer. She was, you know, it was pretty much a death sentence. But he, Dr. Donald, with his ultrasound, found out it was a very easily removable ovarian cyst and saved the woman's life. And it was published in The Lancet in 1958, actually. And then it became more readily used after that.
Cool.
Very helpful technique.
Indeed.
So here we are all back at home from the amazing meeting H. You guys have a good time?
It sucked.
Did the better.
It was awesome.
It was a lot of work. A great time, but definitely a lot of work. We were on the go as usual with no time to sit down, relax, and listen to all the talks that were going on and everything.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the DVDs coming out of this one because, unfortunately, I missed a lot of them, a lot of the talks. But I heard that they were great, and the view that I saw were great.
I heard the same thing. I heard the talks were awesome. What'd you guys hear about the talks?
It is ironic that we don't get to hear a lot of the talks since we're too busy either interviewing people or running events or preparing for our own events. You know, it's
manning the table.
Yeah,
Dawkins was there.
Richard Dawkins was the keynote. He was interviewed by DJ Grothy, and it was very interesting. The most interesting part of that interview for me was when DJ got Richard Dawkins to admit that if it were up to him, he would have given Bill Maher the Richard Dawkins Award for 2009.
He would have.
Yeah. So no way for him to distance himself from that decision.
No.
The interview was very interesting. DJ, I think, did a good job.
Do you guys think, that I'm not cutting Dawkins any slack? I mean, I think we need to hold each other up to a high, we have to be very critical on each other as well, right? But do you think Dawkins said that just so he didn't contradict what his organization did? Maybe there is a deeper truth than what he said.
I don't think Dawkins has that sort of political scheming in his heart. I think he's just saying the truth.
And now, if there are other questions that DJ asked him as well, where I think he made it pretty clear that in Dawkins' mind, religious faith is the most important topic to address from a scientific point of view, period. That's the biggest thing that needs to be dealt with in his mind. So it makes perfect sense then to give somebody like Bill Maher that award.
But change the name of the award. Don't have science in the name.
Well, yeah, that was you're right. If it was purely an atheist award, nobody would have said
no
boo.
No problem.
Right.
Yeah, I agree.
Coming up is also Tam London. Rebecca, I assume you're going to be at Tam London.
So yeah, I am going to Tam London. I'm very excited about it, and I've been a small amount of help, I think, in helping arrange a few speakers and get some cool fringe activities lined up. And I think that this year, like last year, was so incredible and so popular. And this year, I think, is actually going to blow it out of the water. The lineup of speakers we've got is just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. Are you guys going to come?
No, not this year, because this year we're going to TAM Australia.
Australia. G'day.
I wish we could go to both, but that's just unfortunate.
So end of November, November 26th, will be TAM Australia. We're all very excited to be going.
Yes.
And which I understand is already sold out.
It's sold out already?
It's sold out in like 6 days.
What? Wow. That's crazy talk.
No, I told Richard you guys didn't have enough seats available.
Apparently not.
Didn't think big enough.
How many seats are there?
I think 600. But they said that the next level up would have been like three times the cost, and they just couldn't take the chance.
Yeah. A lot of people think that the bigger the conference, the cheaper it will be. Like you get some sort of group discount, but it's just not true. It's so difficult to find big conference centers and stuff to hold all these skeptics. It's a good problem to have, though.
Yeah.
You know, people are so pumped about these events that they're flying in from all around the world. So.
Yeah, I thought TAM actually hit that final number, the 1,300 number, which seems to be right around the zone where it's a little bit too big.
No.
It was really hard to it's not an intimate occasion anymore. Now it's a really big conference with a ton of people, and it's crowded everywhere you go. And I like it. It's great. It didn't really diminish it for me. It's just not the same TAM as TAM 5 or 6, say. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but when conferences grow like that, then they start to evolve as well, and you get more breakout sessions and subgroups and, you know what I mean, more intimate meetings happen within the larger meeting.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that's going to turn some people off, but it's just an unfortunate fact that, you know, these things have to evolve. Look at like Dragon Con or something like that for what the future of TAM might be.
Wow.
Tracks and panels and things like that. Who
but knows? Could you imagine a skeptical / science, you know, event happening with 40 plus thousand people going? I mean, my God, that would be incredible.
I can't.
No, we're a long way from incredible. That. And speaking of Dragon Con, if you are not able to make it to any of the TAMs this year, there is still Dragon Con in Atlanta, Georgia. The September 3rd weekend, there was a very active science, skeptic, and podcasting track there run by Derek and Swoopy and others, of course. We will not be able to make it this year.
I might be able to make it.
Rebecca's a maybe.
I'm trying. Yeah. I really want to because, you know, after TAM and Convergence and everything, I really want to. So
guys, how are we ever going to keep up with all of these new events? I mean, you know, we have our Nexus event in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
TAM.
Well, we'll see. I mean, we'll do as many of these as we can.
Or, you know, some billionaire is listening and says, you know what? I want these kids to go around the world talking about science and skepticism. And then they'll just pay to fly us all over the place.
That'd be nice. Mm.
Ta-da.
Billionaire podcast.
Problem solved.
Problem solved.
There's no problem too large that it can't be solved by fantasizing.
Right.
Absolutely.
The good news for our listeners is that we did record a lot of very awesome interviews while we were at TAM, so you'll be enjoying that content over the next couple of months. Starting with this week, we have a great interview with both Randy and Banachek together. We did a new thing. We tried whenever possible to interview more than one person at once so we get more of a dynamic going on. Because we could do the individual interviews whenever we want. This was an opportunity to have, you know, more than one person at a time. So we're starting with Randy and Banachek.
I think it worked out. Interview. Yeah, it worked out great.
It did. It worked out really well.
The double interviews.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to some news items for this week. Bob, tell us about the new monster star.
Yeah, this one surprised me. Scientists apparently have found the biggest star ever, and it's a porker. You guys, the accepted
porker.
Yeah,
is that a scientific term?
It is. I just coined it 4 hours ago. The accepted limit for the biggest stars. If you kind of asked around and you asked astronomers, you know, what's the biggest star? How big can they really get? And they probably throw you a number like 150 solar masses around there. A solar mass is, of course, the sun's mass, which is, I looked this up, it's about 333,000 Earths or 4.4 nonillion pounds, which is...
Nonillion?
Yeah, which is 4.4 followed by 30 zeros. So it's heavy, obviously. So that's a solar mass. Basically, our sun is one solar mass. This guy, they gave it the boring name of R136A1. So come on, guys, the biggest star ever, and that's the best you can do. Why can't they just get creative? Like, whoever named the quarks, like Charm and Strange, Give it a cool name. I don't know.
Is that a temporary designation until they name it, do you think?
I think it might get multiple designations, but that's pretty much, that's its name, and it'll probably stick.
Wasn't Murray Gell-man? We should call him.
Yeah, right.
Didn't he name the Charm Quark and Strange Quark?
I think so. I'm not sure.
Or what about that? Wasn't there a giant shark or something that we talked about a while back, and it was just called like Giganto Shark?
Gigantus, yeah. Something like that. Gigantus Maximus.
Get that guy working on it.
Yeah. That's so much better.
In the big scheme of things, is this star as big as stars get, or is this just an extraordinarily large star but not the top size?
You're kind of cutting into my conclusion there, Jay. But yeah, this one here is the biggest that has ever been found. And I guess I should tell you how big it is first.
Yes,
it's 265 solar masses. And they believe that that when it was younger, when it first ignited, it was about 320 solar masses, which is really staggering, especially when you consider that they pretty much thought that 150 solar masses was the maximum or close to it.
Why would they think that anything is the maximum? What limits a star's size in the first place?
Well, the thing is you've got this radiation pressure pushing outwards. At some point you reach a pressure outwards that, you know, that solar wind is so strong that there really can't be any more influx of gas to beef up the mass of the sun. So you kind of reach a point where it really can't take on any more because there's just too much solar wind coming out. So this is kind of why they think that. Plus, the other reason is that wherever they look, they couldn't find anything bigger, you know, like in the Milky Way, especially, I think. They couldn't find anything bigger than 150. So they figured, all right, so that's pretty much it. I saw some news item where somebody found 200 solar masses, but it was never really got beyond that. But,
does that burn at a different color, Bob?
It burns hotter, so it's gonna be burning at different colors than stars with the mass of our sun. This star isn't in our galaxy; it's in a neighboring galaxy, the Large Magellanic Cloud. It's 30 times the radius of our sun. Now, when I first read that, I said, "Wait, that's not that huge a diameter," and it's really not when you compare it to like red giants. You know, you've probably read about red giants, red giant stars that puff out beyond like the orbit of Venus or close to the Earth or more. They can get pretty huge, but they're so diffuse that they just don't have the mass that this one does. So just in terms of pure mass, this guy is the king. It's also 10 million times brighter. I found that surprising. 10 million times brighter. Astronomer Paul Crowther at the University of Sheffield said that if you replace the sun in our solar system, it would outshine it by as much as the sun currently outshines the full moon. So this thing would be very, you know, obviously blindingly bright. I wonder what it would do to light. I'm sure it would just wipe out tons of stuff. That's 10 million, toast.
Yeah. They also noted that the edges would not be sharp like our sun is, that they would be fuzzy because the atmosphere is like constantly, as you say, being wispy and blown off.
If you could actually get close to this guy, it wouldn't look really distinct. It wouldn't have nice clean edges like our sun does. It would look fuzzy like you say, Steve, and that's because of the solar wind. This thing is just, you know, exfoliating bits of itself through the solar wind, and that's why it's a lot less massive now than it was a few million years ago. But the other thing you would notice if you were like right next to this thing, besides the tremendous heat, is that there would be like no planets, really probably no planets around this thing. And if there are planets, they just wouldn't last long enough for anything interesting to happen because these stars, they only last a few million years, maybe 3 or 4 million years, because they have such a voracious appetite. They're just blowing through their hydrogen and everything else so fast that they just don't last long at all.
Will this collapse into a nice big black hole?
That's an interesting question. Actually, this guy is so massive that they think that there wouldn't be any remnant left over after it blows. It would pretty much just blow out everything. All the heavy metals that are created out into, and that's actually a good thing because it would, you know, you're seeding space with the heavy, you know, with the heavy metals. But that was interesting that once you reach a certain point, they think that it really wouldn't, there'd be nothing left to form a black hole.
They don't really know what this life cycle is going to be because there's no precedence for this.
Yeah. They're not sure, but some of the articles I did the research on were saying that, and that's what they're thinking. And the other big thing about this is that it basically gives you a glimpse into the early universe because this is what early stars were like. They were this massive because we're limited in the Milky Way because the resources aren't there anymore. And that's why we have this 150 solar mass limit. There's just not enough gas left around to really pile it on to create these titanic stars. So they think, and this is a glimpse of what stars were like in the early universe soon after the Big Bang, because there's just so much stuff around there that there were stars this size, and really you could just keep going. If you have enough gas around, you could really just, who knows, perhaps you can go to 400, 500, or 600 solar masses if you have the resources available.
I think it deserves a new classification, not just a star. I think it needs to be a superstar.
Superstar?
Superstar.
I like megastar, because you already have superstars.
I think I'm partial to megastar myself.
I like ultrastar.
Ultrastar?
Hyperstar?
Right, the only way to solve this is with a nerd fight.
Hyper's good, too. No. It's an ultra-hyperstar. That's it.
Ultra-hyper-mega-superstar.
Get out your 12-sided die and let's settle this once and for all.
Well, I don't know which one to pick. I have them in 10 different colors, so...
Jay, tell us about the recent victory against anti-vaccine kooks in Australia.
This was great. So this happened, what, a couple of weeks ago?
It was just announced, I think two weeks ago.
There's a TV show in Australia called Sunday Night that ran an expose about what happens to parents who don't vaccinate their kids. And to start off, I want to mention that the host of the show, Chris Bath, and the reporter, Rebecca Mattern, actually should be thanked. They did a great job of covering the topic. Some people did report that they gave the anti-vaxxers a little bit too much screen time or whatever, but they did actually hit home very hard, how incredibly serious this situation is to get children vaccinated. So basically, here's what happens in the story that they followed. It was a show about a four-week-old baby named Dana McCaffrey, and very, very sadly, she died of whooping cough. She was only 4 weeks old. She was 2 weeks away from being able to get the vaccination, and she missed it. So you got to keep in mind, whooping cough is a preventable disease, and vaccines, kicked its ass a long time ago, and it is an amazingly strong way of preventing it and, not allowing children to get this ridiculously bad disease. And it's a horrible way to die. So the real reason why she died was a lack of herd immunity. That was the root cause of it. So in Dana's situation, the region where she lives happens to have low vaccination numbers. So this leads to higher occurrences of whatever the disease is. And because more people in Dana's neighborhood in that area had whooping cough, she caught it, where she wouldn't have if everyone had been properly vaccinated, and she caught it and she died. This story really becomes punctuated when you think about, because people are spreading misinformation about vaccinations and less people are getting vaccinated, Dana died because of that. Mm-hmm. So those people, anti-vaxxers, are responsible for her death. So we move on to Merrill Dorey, who runs the Australian Vaccination Network. And don't let the name kid you. This is not about positive information about vaccinations. They're an anti-vax organization. And she was the person on that program speaking out against vaccinations. So she basically talked about the typical inane anti-vax claims that we all know. She's also an HIV denier, which I found very interesting. She said that Dana did not die from whooping cough. All her kids caught it. They all survived. It wasn't that big of a deal. So they're really, her group is claiming that Dana did not die from the whooping cough, which is not the case. That's not the facts. Dana's parents, Tony and Dave McCafferty, said that they're being harassed by Dana's organization, the AVN, mm-hmm. since their daughter died. And the AVN has made repeated claims that Dana didn't die of the disease, and they're basically saying, tell us the real truth in the story, and they're like putting a lot of information out about how the parents aren't being completely honest about what's going on.
Wow.
Her parents were quoted as saying, it began the day before her funeral. It began with the phone calls to the health department to get her medical records, contending she didn't die of pertussis, which is whooping cough. So that's horrible, but there is really good news that came out. Not too long ago, the AVN was found to give misleading and inaccurate information to its followers and to the general public, according to an Australian government investigation.
This is the Healthcare Complaints Commission, the HCCC,
right,
which had received complaints about the AVN, and their judgment was extremely negative, basically saying that they provide inaccurate information and basically essentially substantiating all the complaints that were made against them.
the AVN now has to make it clear that they're an anti-vaccination group. They have to display it prominently as a disclaimer on their homepage, stating that they're anti-vax and that the information provided by their organization is not actual medical advice. Ooh. And that a decision to vaccinate or not should be made after consulting an actual healthcare provider, which
awesome. Wow.
Well, Jay, the HCCC is requesting that they do that. And as our colleagues down under, Rachel Dunlop, for example, pointed out, that if the AVN refuses, the HCCC doesn't really have any teeth to force them to do it.
Aww.
So this decision was made in part of the work that Richard Saunders and Rachel Dunlop and the Australian Skeptics did. And if we go back to August of 2009, if you guys remember, Dr. Rachie told us that they ran a quarter-page ad in a national newspaper stating the AVN is spreading misinformation and risking lives of children, and they point parents in the right direction on where to get good information about vaccinations. And then, just on a side note, the Australian Skeptics also gave Dory their annual Bent Spoon Award last year. And that was awarded to her for being the perpetrator of the most preposterous piece of paranormal or pseudoscientific piffle.
Ha!
Piffle?
So, yeah.
Piffle.
So, wow. Richard and Rachel really did make a difference with the work that they're doing, and their work is showing effect now, which is fantastic.
Yeah, they've done a wonderful job. Meryl Dory is, I mean, just such a horrific person. If you don't follow Dr. Rachie on Twitter, you should. And yeah, she tweeted that the whole story of Dory was actually accusing skeptics of influencing the McCaffreys, of hounding the McCaffreys and encouraging them to believe, you know, the big pharma lies. And it's so sad that it needed to be done, but, you know, they compiled all of this information that showed this very obvious timeline that the McCaffreys backed up, that showed Meryl Dory and her AVN thugs basically hounded these grieving parents in order to first try to prove that the child didn't die of whooping cough, and then when they couldn't do that, to what seemed to be kind of strong arm them into shutting up about it, or to try to convince them that for some reason they were wrong about it. It was just heartbreaking.
They are thugs. They're like the Age of Autism here in the United States. They're complete thugs.
Yeah.
That attack anyone who disagrees with them, basically.
Calling people baby eaters.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are the kind of tactics that they resort to. Well, Evan, tell us why the governor of New York is wearing a red bracelet around his right wrist.
To rid himself of evil spirits and the evil eye, protect himself against the evil eye. As do all believers of the Kabbalah and the red bracelet, the red thread wearers, as they say.
Mm. So this is a Kabbalah superstitious luck charm.
Yes. That's exactly what it is.
Although he doesn't actually believe in Kabbalah, apparently. I don't know why he's wearing it, but...
Well, that's
Madonna wears one.
Yeah, although at least she follows through and claims to actually believe in it, even though she believes in the dumbed-down celebrity version. That's the thing with these things. Nobody ever really bothers with the serious part of it. So it's like, yeah, I believe in Kabbalah, so I wear this red string and stuff, and I'm very spiritual. Oh, these tattoos? Yeah, no, they're fine. Kabbalah doesn't allow tattoos? Well, you know, it does now. It's like they just pick and choose. It's pathetic.
Whatever works.
Governor David Paterson of New York. He's a lame duck governor, which means he is not running for re-election coming up in the fall. So he's just serving out his term. But in the past 6 months, he's found himself under investigation. He had to get out of his re-election campaign as a result. And he's been in problems with the state legislature over state budgets. And of course, they're way, way, way in the red. So a lot of negative things happening recently in Governor Paterson's life. So what the heck, right? Put a Kabbalah bracelet on. And
yeah, well, his spokesperson said he's doing it because he'll take any help he can get, even if it's fake. Yeah. Even if it's fake. I added the fake part, but yeah, that's what she said. And also, what's funny is apparently he's wearing it on the wrong wrist. It's supposed to be on the left side. He's got it on the right.
What? Oh, really?
Now it's never going to work. Wait, maybe that's what the other people have been doing wrong all this time. Maybe he realized that Kabbalah bracelets did absolutely nothing, and he figured, well, it was probably the wrist. Just change it to the other wrist. So,
there you go.
Makes sense, really.
According to people who believe this kind of stuff, the left, you wear it on the left in order to draw in positive energy. It's like the entry point.
Oh, okay.
Where things come in, so, but it wards off the evil, bad stuff. Now, if you have it on the right, it didn't exactly say, but I imagine the right is the outward.
So it would drain you of your
direction of your energy.
Yeah, like an energy vampire.
Yeah, maybe that's his problem.
It could be. It could be. He's got many problems.
Energy vampires. Kabbalah bracelets don't work against energy vampires. You need a Kabbalah bracelet made of garlic and silver.
It's silver, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lots of celebrities wear these things. Not just Madonna. But there's also professional athletes that have been seen wearing these. So it's the Hollywood. And now, apparently, politicians have gotten in on the act. I guess they feel left out to some degree, I would suppose. So that's it. Kabbalah on the wrist of a governor of New York. That's a first.
Well, we have a couple of monkey news items to talk about.
Yay, monkey business.
Monkey news is always the best. The first one is a new fossil monkey that was discovered. Now, this is an old world monkey discovered in Saudi Arabia that's about 29 million years old.
That's old.
Yep. The Latin name is Sedanius hygezensis. This was published in the journal Nature by Dr. William Sanders from the University of Michigan, who led the research. What's interesting about this fossil, this is one of those actual possible missing links, you know, where it may connect different branches of the primate tree. Old world monkeys split off from apes around 30 million years ago. The thinking was mainly from genetic evidence that it was between 30 and 35 million years ago. This fossil is about 29 million years old, and it has features that are found in both apes and old world monkeys, which anatomically makes it look like a common ancestor of both. However, because it's 29 million years old, that puts it a little bit later than the branching point between apes and old world monkeys based upon genetic evidence.
It's not within the error bars, though?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it seems like, you know, 29, 30 million. That sounds like it's within the error bars. Plus, you know, always with these specimens, this could be, a downstream descendant of the population of primates that represent the common ancestor, you know, of the old world monkeys and the gibbons. So, you know, if surviving for a couple of million years after they split is nothing. No one fossil can really, throw the timeline into disarray because you never know where it fits into the bigger picture. You need multiple fossils to see, you know, where are these species beginning and ending. And so I think that the news items about this are a little bit misleading in terms of the implications of this fossil.
What about the location, Steve? Saudi Arabia? That's not exactly a hotbed for fossils. It seems
it is. For primate fossils? Yeah, the Middle East. Yeah, the Middle East is, absolutely.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's not like Africa, but it's...
Well, we talk about China, we talk about Africa, you know, those places come in. North America, we don't it seems we haven't brought up the Middle East all that much when it comes to
fossils. I think
just,
smaller area, you know, geopolitically, but it's, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's lots of human fossils have been found in the Middle East. So, yeah, it's an area that produces fossils. Just to contrast this with Ida, you guys remember Ida?
Yeah.
Idaho? Yeah.
This was the fossil that was discovered last year that was surrounded with all the hype.
Yeah, hubbub.
Yeah, this is sort of the promoting science gone awry. You know, really failed attempt at sensationalizing or popularizing science. And they were basically saying that Ida was the missing link between the branch of primates that led to monkeys and apes and prosimians like lemurs. So this is now going farther back in time, that about 47 million years, an earlier branching point between the oldest types of primates, the prosimians, and then the branch that led to monkeys and apes. Whereas this is now downstream of that branch after the New World monkeys split off and at the base where the branching point between Old World monkeys and apes. So at about 30 million years. And this one is probably an actual, or at least close to an actual common ancestor as opposed to Ida, which is still being hotly debated and may not really provide that link at all between monkeys and prosimians.
Fascinating.
Fascinating. But Rebecca's going to give us some other monkey news.
Yes, there is more monkey news. This is in our continuing tradition of seemingly lighthearted stories that actually make you hate humanity.
Mm-hmm.
I think it must have been several years ago that we reported on the man who went through airport security and yelled, "There are monkeys in my pants." Someone else has done it. Mexican authorities have just arrested a man who had 18 monkeys around his waist and stuffed into his socks.
What?
18. That's
well,
right.
I think the monkeys were stuffed into socks and then hung around his waist, I think is...
Not actually in his socks.
Not in his socks, on his feet, yeah.
So what was he wearing? Painter's pants? Like what?
He was wearing monkey pants, obviously.
Monkey pants.
He was wearing... Remember, MC Hammer used to wear these big things that could hold about 18 monkeys.
Right. Yeah, skids or
that was the golden age for animal smugglers. when Hammer's fashion was
busted.
Hammer
well,
time.
Because there were 18 monkeys in his pants, Jay. That's how he got busted. You just can't do that. According
Did he actually
to
get on the plane.
According, yeah, he made it to Mexico. He made it to Mexico City. He was stopped at a random check and. According to police, he was behaving, quote, nervously, as you would if you have 18 monkeys in your pants. They're titi monkeys, which some species of which are endangered, although the article wasn't clear if the ones in his pants were endangered.
I think they all are. There's like three species in this genus, and it's the only... I think it's like a remnant of a previously larger group, and I think they're all endangered.
The article I read said many are, but yeah, okay. Regardless, they sell for apparently upwards of like $1,500 each. So, I mean, they're just tiny little things. So,
well, I would think if they were in his pants for all that time, that the ones that he had would be really endangered, right? I mean,
well,
would die.
That's true because two of them died. Two of them died when. He was caught.
No.
So, or they had already died when he was caught.
Nice.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the whole hating humanity part.
It's so two of the 18 died, or only two survived?
Two of the 18 died.
I've been on planes many times and sat next to tons of really weird people under weird circumstances, but how can you sit next to a guy with 18 monkeys in his pants and not know it?
Right. Surely there's at least a smell.
Well, yeah, you think exactly. The stench would kind of.
Well, one thing that's not clear here is because
something's not right.
He
here.
Said that they were in his luggage, and then he moved them out of the luggage and then into his pants to go through customs because he didn't want them to get X-rayed. Didn't want them to go through the X-rays. So I don't know.
That's
if
a bit
he,
odd though, because yeah. The way like if they must have been in his carry-on baggage then.
Maybe.
Yeah, he must have had like a carry-on because if it was checked, he wouldn't get that until he was through customs.
Right, yeah, must have been a carry-on.
Yeah, so, he probably nipped to the bathroom, shoved a bunch of monkeys in his pants, and then...
Right, and looked very nervous.
And that doesn't go unnoticed. I mean, what about the noise factor? How do you get 18 anything to not make any noise?
And these are supposed to be especially chatty monkeys.
Maybe they were...
Drugged?
Yeah, drugged monkeys.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's depressing, though. People do not purchase wild animals as pets. If you do that, this is your fault.
Supporting monkey smuggling.
Yes, don't support monkey smuggling.
These are cute little monkeys, too.
They're adorable, but they're much more adorable in the wild when they're not.
Yeah, and when they're alive.
Clawing your crotch.
But this is smuggling rare animals up through South America, through Mexico to the United States is actually big business.
Apparently he paid $30 for them. He paid $30 each in Peru and figuring that you can sell them for about at least a grand. I mean, that's a pretty good markup.
Yeah, it's pretty good. One more news item. This is a update on our coverage of the whole libel laws thing. In the United States, the federal government has recently passed a libel tourism bill. So libel tourism is the notion that people who are suing someone else for libel will file their suit in a country that has laws that are favorable to those suing for libel, and where it's very difficult to defend against libel. And especially if you're trying to make a nuisance out of yourself, you know, you want to do it in someplace like in England, where it's really expensive to defend against even a frivolous case.
Not just someplace like England. England.
England, yeah. But England, there are other places as well. Other places
well,
that have been.
England is really the place to go. It's by far the most expensive.
Other ones that were noted, though, include Brazil, Australia. I hadn't heard that before. Indonesia and Singapore. Yeah.
It is pretty bad in Australia, I think, because they take their laws from England.
Yeah,
and
maybe.
Kept them pretty much as is.
But in the U.S. of A., we cherish our freedom of speech. This is now a federal law that was being passed, and I think still needs to be signed by the president, but got through the House of Representatives. And was approved in the Senate by a unanimous consent voice
vote.
Yeah, that's rare. And essentially, they said that libel suits that can be filed in other countries against our citizens can have a chilling effect on a protected speech, and therefore they need to pass these protections for American citizens so they don't get targeted by these libel tourism acts. And essentially, this doesn't prevent somebody from filing a suit in England against an American citizen. But what it means is that the U.S. federal courts don't have to abide by them. They will not freeze a person's assets or in any way essentially adhere to the judgments of these foreign libel courts. So essentially, you can't. The U.S. courts will not in any way facilitate this libel tourism occurring in other countries, which is nice.
Yeah, I can tell you that's a huge win for people here in England who are fighting for libel reform, because it really illustrates for the MPs here the fact that the United States isn't taking English law seriously, and it's a huge blow to English law, and it really helps push the issue. So, yay, U.S.
Yeah.
Good job.
Nice job.
Well, let's go on to Who's That Noisy, Evan? We got to get caught up from weeks ago.
We do. It has been weeks ago, hasn't it? It's been almost a month. Well, I'm sure you all remember, but for those of you who don't remember, here is the last Who's That Noisy we did a few weeks ago. Here it goes.
A baby R2-D2.
That was my guess.
No. Yeah, this was one that stumped a lot of people. In fact, it stumped everyone. Nobody got this one correctly. That is our friend, well, nature's friend, I should say, the lemming.
Oh. Lemmings are cute.
A small rodent.
Never would have guessed
usually
it.
Usually found in or near the Arctic and in tundra areas of the planet.
Hmm. Yeah, some animals make a sound that actually is reminiscent of machinery, of like computer bleeps. The one that always gets me is the brown-headed cowbird.
Oh, yeah, me too.
How's that go?
Me too.
It does kind of a bloopy sound to it. You would think that it's like a computer or a machine or something.
You'd think so.
What do you got for this week, Evan?
All right, this week, we actually have a person talking this week. Let's see if you can figure out who this is.
Ask yourself only, what are the facts and what is the truth that the facts bear out? Never let yourself be diverted either by what you would wish to believe or by what you think would have beneficent social effects if it were believed.
What accent was that?
That was stuffy.
It's a posh accent.
Posh?
Posh.
Good job, Evan.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting one, so give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
All right, well, let's go on to our interview. Well, we are sitting here with James Randi. James, welcome back.
A pleasure to be here, Steve.
And Banachek.
Good to be here.
It's good to have the two of you together. We've talked about some of the experiences you've shared before, but it was always with one of you or the other at the same time, like the the Alpha Project, of course.
Yes.
So, do you guys have any other, you know, adventures, I guess, that you did together other than the Alpha Project?
We do.
Yeah, we do.
Peter, Popoff?
Yes, Popoff, yep. Of course. You know, Steve, well, it seems like I've always known Steve. It's not true. But it seems like I was sort of born around the corner. Because when was the first time that we ever met?
Let's go back before we even talk about that and bring us back to that. Because I wrote you a letter. Read your book, The Truth About Uri Geller. Yes. And from that, I was able to put some methods for bending silverware together to the point to where the entire cafeteria at the school went to plastic silverware until I graduated. So I got expelled for making the clock go off early. There were numerous stories, all thanks to Randy, of course.
All sort of stuff, yes. You know, you understand.
So I got a little cocky back in those days. I mean, I was never a cocky human being, but cocky in the aspect thinking I could fool anybody. So I sent Randy a letter, said, look, if you ever need a kid to try to fool scientists, you know, I'd be happy to do that. So Randy said, look, if you're ever in the area, come and visit. And in fact, there was one point where you had a friend in Washington, Pennsylvania, who had a private plane.
Yes.
I don't remember his name, but and you said maybe you can catch a flight with him sometime. And that didn't quite work out, but I did catch a bus out there, and I met Randy, and went to his house. And Randy never showed me a single trick that trip, and I was disappointed. But what it was, I found out years later, there was a reason for it. He was already plotting. He wanted to look at my character, see who I was, see if he wanted to work with me, I guess, and see if I had any talent at all. Because if the opportunity ever came about, he wanted to be able to tell the scientists that, yes, here's a kid that taught himself. Can you imagine if I had trained him what he would have been able to do?
You didn't realize you were being tested by the master.
I didn't realize that at the time. I was just disappointed. It was like, oh, man, here's a guy, you know, I read his book, and he taught me so much through the book. And, you know, here's a guy that I respect. And he just like, you know, the one thing he did show me, because I was young and I didn't eat yogurt, he showed me, because I hated the taste of yogurt, but I didn't realize you had to mix the yogurt up back in those days to get the flavor in it. So I do remember that. He did show me that.
He
taught me that. Exactly. Yeah.
It was the best thing I ever taught him. How to stir your yogurt.
I got to tell you what I was amazed by is that the whole time I was there, I mean, he's like a machine. He was doing radio interviews, newspaper interviews, on the phone. In fact, the second time I came to visit you, Mike Edwards, the other kid in the Alpha Project, we came to stay there at his house. And we were in there. Mike and I were just goofing it up and laughing and everything. And next thing you know, there's a pen that comes flying out of the office. There's a bookmark in a book that comes flying. And he was doing an interview. And we were like being really, really loud. And the more he threw stuff out of the office at us, the more we were laughing. You probably don't remember that.
I remember
Mike
it
and
very
I remember
well.
It very well. And the more he did it, the more we laughed and everything. So, and the next thing you see, like metal pots and everything's coming out.
They wouldn't
out of
take a hint. If I throw the toilet seat out there, they would have said, oh, there's a toilet seat. You know?
Exactly right.
They wouldn't have slowed down one bit.
Randy, what did you think of Banachek early on?
Well, he's obviously very bright. Both him and Mike more or less impressed me the same way.
Bad dresser, though.
Well, that's true. but we soon healed that situation.
Yes.
No, they were both impressive kids. I had a tough schedule to follow, though, because I wanted to be able to say in the future that I didn't train these kids how to do magic tricks. They're amateur magicians. I wanted to keep that a Simon Pure claim, you know, that no one could argue with. And I wasn't showing them any methods at all, and I wasn't showing them any tricks, as Steve said. But that was for a very good purpose, and it worked out just fine because I was able to go into the Alpha Project with great integrity and know that what I was saying was absolutely true and had no fault in it.
And to clarify for our listeners, when you say Steve, you're referring to Banachek's real name.
That's true.
Not me.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Pardon
me,
Steve.
Yeah, right.
I mean Steve 2.
Yeah.
Or 1 or whatever.
Prime.
So going back to the original story, so, you know, Randy and I, of course, have had a strong friendship as a result of Project Alpha, and even, you know, through the years for that. And Randy was writing an article. It was Penthouse magazine, was it not, on the Evangelists? It was Penthouse or Hustler. It was one of the two.
Not Hustler, no.
Okay, then it was Penthouse.
Probably was, yes.
Larry Flint. Yeah.
So he was going to see. It was about evangelists, you know, and about some of the fake methods and things that they do. And he said, "Hey, do you want to come along?" So I came along. And I remember it well. You know, we were stage right up in back up on the balcony up there looking down.
Was that in San Francisco?
It was in Houston, Texas.
Houston,
where
exactly.
I lived. That's where I was able to go. Yeah. I'm sitting there, and Peter Popoff, this evangelist, he's coming out there. He say, Mrs. Johnson, where are you? Over on the left somewhere, over in this section here. Yeah, your father is James. Is that correct? Yes. And your doctor is Dr. Smith. Is that correct? Yeah. And Dr. Smith says this about you. And he's giving all this information. So Randy and I are sitting there, and Randy goes, you know, this guy, you know, he's good, but he's getting, you know, a lot of information about people. Maybe he's using mnemonics. And I said to Randy, I said, I don't know. I do a good bit with mnemonics. And, you know, as Randy knows as well, I said, you know, he's getting a lot of information. With mnemonics, you usually get a little information about a lot of information about a little.
Can you explain what that is briefly? So
mnemonics is memory systems. They're very, like, very basic would be, like, one would be gun, two would be shoe, three would be tree. So if you want to remember one object, like a loaf of bread, you might think of a gun shooting a loaf of bread and the bread exploding, you know. Two would be a shoe, and maybe you want to think of, I don't know,
a shoe.
Name something. Well, a shoe would be, yeah. But I don't know, a lion or something like that. So now you imagine the lion biting the shoe, you know.
Right.
And this way, all you could do is one gun. Okay, what's the gun? Oh, I remember shooting the loaf of bread. Two is a shoe. What's that? Oh, the lion is eating that. So it's just, it basically, it's these tools that you use to memorize long lists or information or numbers or books, poetry. You can use it for all kinds of things to memorize things, names, everything else.
Basically a memory system.
It's a memory system.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is, yeah. So Peter Popoff at one point, he says, I need ushers. And Randy's like, go! You know, so I'm like, all right. So I run down there, and I get down there, and I get the last bucket. And these ushers...
That's for collecting money, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. No, exactly. And so I walk around with this bucket, and I'm to collect this money. And I must have had, I had thousands and thousands of dollars in here. And I actually had to walk outside and come back around to get it to him. And as I'm walking out, I'm going, geez, you know, I could just keep going
right?
with this. Yeah, but
where's
that,
the parking lot?
That wasn't all. You know, you dump the money out, and now you got to go get the sealed offerings.
Yeah.
And you go around, get those, and then you go around to round up the people that didn't give anything in like checks and things like that. So you do that too. So he's getting all this money. As I'm down there, I look up, and I notice this man of God doesn't have an ear hole. So I come back to Ryan. I said, you're not going to believe this. I said, you know, either this man of God cannot heal himself and he's using a hearing aid, or somebody is, you know, sending him information. Randy said, are you absolutely sure? I said, yeah. And then Randy, in his brilliance at that point, I think it was in San Francisco, you went and got the guy from MIT, and you want to take it when there with the frequencies and all that and how
Well, what we did was I went to my friend Alec Jason. Alec Jason was a private investigator, and he knew a great deal, still does, to this very day, a great deal about electronics and surveillance machines and whatnot. He's the expert on the very, very latest that's available in this sort of thing, everything from cameras to hidden transmitters and such. He volunteered to go in there, and what a job he did. He dressed up as a laborer with big boots on and such, and looking like an electrician. And he hung so many bits of identification around his neck, all with his picture on it, stuff that he had just laminated at home.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. He put it all – there was so much of it, the security guard would just look at him coming and just wave him by.
Nope.
You know, impatiently. He just say, I'm not going to go through all that crap. You know?
I got to use that at a concert. I didn't even think about it. That's great.
Yeah, it works great in concerts, I'm told, yeah. And so he would pass – and Alec would always be wearing headphones and – sort of trucking on down, you know, snapping his fingers as if he was listening to music. And he had a little player pinned to his chest, and you could see it there with the light on. But that wasn't working. He wasn't listening to music. He was listening to the reception he was getting on a secret receiver that he had there that scanned all of the different frequencies that were in use in the area. And as soon as it would lock in on one, he'd either cancel it out by pressing a button on, as if he were tuning the machine, you see, to get more jazz coming into his headphones, or it would move ahead to the next one, and it would record each one of the frequencies that was being used. He was listening to see if there was a frequency being used. And what was it, 107.6
I don't remember
like
what it was.
Yeah, whatever it was. Anyway, it was in the megahertz range. And he just gave me a sign at one point with a thumbs up secretly. I was standing over to the side there, and I knew he had it. And he came back to me and he said, yeah, here's the frequency right here. And he put the headphones on me, and you could hear Mrs. Popoff talking.
Yeah.
And we made recording from that point on. He had a recorder with him, of course.
The voice of God was a woman.
That's right.
So all you guys are actually went to several events that Popoff was having, you know, these fundraisers.
I actually only went to the one in Houston with Randy, and then Randy took it from there and went to a lot of different
Went to several of them after that, and we got recordings on every one of them. And I'll tell you, I don't know whether I've ever told you about this, Steve. We've got recordings of Popoff and his wife. Well, Popoff just doing praise Jesus, you know, the kind of thing. And the wife talking to him in the background. And she is saying things that are so reprehensible. The first one that we got was at the beginning of one of the broadcasts where you hear her saying, "Hello, Petey, can you hear me? This is your wife. If you can't hear me, you're in deep trouble."
And then you see him nod on the video
And you see him nod on the video. And she's seeing him by return images.
Yeah. She's in a truck outside watching the monitor.
Yes. Can you imagine? And but then the stuff gets really nasty. Can I use bad language?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, this, and I have the recording, so if Peter Popoff wants to come after me on this, Peter, I got the recording. Just bear that in mind. You actually hear Mrs. Popoff say, laughing, first of all, with another woman, and I think that was, what is his name, Reefer somebody or other. Do you remember that name?
I can't. Yeah.
His wife, I believe. His wife. What was happening is the two women were laughing because they saw a man. This is tough to say. A man in a wheelchair with testicular cancer, a huge tumor, the size of a football.
Yeah. Oh, and they would say hot one, laugh, right?
Yes, yes, and they were laughing at this man in his agony. He had tears streaming down his face. And she's saying to Peter, "Peter, I know your secret life, you know. You keep your hands off those balls, and I'm watching you. This is your wife." And they're laughing away at this poor, unfortunate man in a terminal condition in this wheelchair. Yeah. And Popoff proceeds to, quote, heal, unquote, the man with this testicular cancer, without saying that it's anything of that nature. He just goes over to him. He's covered in a blanket, and he waves his hands over and blesses him, and then moves on. But
the one I heard that really disgusted me was they were laughing, and there was a woman who had tumors in her breast.
That's right.
And they're telling Peter to make her run up and down the aisle and shake her breasts.
Yeah.
And they're laughing about this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And also, I think in the very same tape, something about it's the big black nigger in the back, and you keep your hands off those tits, Peter. I'm watching.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, this is
disgusting stuff. Just disgusting stuff.
I had no idea that was going on. Yeah. I mean, I've seen the program a ton of times, watched it on YouTube. But
you wouldn't know that, of course.
Yeah. Well, he was using all the Catherine Coleman tricks, too, the thing where people come to these things hours ahead of time. They check themselves out of hospitals from doctor's care to come to these things on stretches and be in there. And what they do is they look for somebody maybe with a cane. They go, okay, that guy's limping. And they walk up to the guy and they say, "You know what? Wouldn't you feel better if we put you in a wheelchair and put you right up front?" And the guy's thinking, you know, and he says, he's thinking, "I'll be close to the man of God." And,
and it's also so the Reverend Popoff will know that you need healing because you're in the wheelchair.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And at the same time, the ushers are asking the guy questions about his doctor and about his condition. As they get all this information, they go back and they write that down. He's right up front, and then Popoff will come out, and he can honestly say to the guy, he can say, "We've never spoke before, have we?" And the guy says, "No." He says, "Your doctor says you'll never be able to walk again." And the guy's thinking, "I'm not going to question this man of God. What he must mean is never be able to walk properly again." And he says, "I say you can, and God says you can." Then he takes a guy's cane and he breaks it. Now think about it. If the guy can't walk, why does he have a cane?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. So he breaks a cane. And these canes are not cheap. They're very expensive. So throws it off to the side, says, "Stand." So there's your first miracle. The guy's standing. And then Popoff sits in the chair. He says, "Go to the back of the chair." And the guy goes to the back of the chair, holds onto the handles. Now it's just like a walker. He says, "Push me around the room." He does. And then the piece de resistance is when he takes a wheelchair, puts it to the other side, and he says, "Now that's your wheelchair light." As if you get out of that chair, you're sitting in right now, and I say, "That's your chair."
He would say something like, "Whose wheelchair is that?"
Oh, yes.
And the man would say, "That's my wheelchair." "Well, it was your wheelchair, longer."
Yeah. Then he says, "Walk back to your wheelchair," and the guy does, and he sits in it. And it's everybody, it's a miracle.
But that guy knew, right?
But they get so caught up in when we were there, I got caught up in the emotions, and I think you probably did too, because it's in a very emotional event. You have people crying, you have people screaming. It's so easy to get caught up in that. And this guy, is feeling some sort of adrenaline flow. He's feeling good at that moment. He's feeling like he's feeling God, you know, in his mind. And so to him, something is happening at that moment. He doesn't question it at that moment.
Yeah.
And there was one event when I went with the CBS TV crew. We went there to tape one of the pop-off meetings. No, wait a minute. I think this was W.V. Grant, but this is a typical procedure that they do use. A woman in the audience stood up from a wheelchair at the head of the audience on the floor, and he commanded her to stand up and everything and walk around, and she walked around with great difficulty, but she walked around, and she broke out in smiles, and she held her hands up in the air, praise Jesus, and she was supposed to have been healed. Well, we followed her outside. We kept track of her. She was dressed in a distinctive dress. We were able to catch her as she left with the audience. And we got the crew to start interviewing her. And you were healed by Reverend Popoff. Oh, yes, praise Jesus, I was healed. And I'm walking again. But she's got the two canes that she came in with. Mm. She wasn't in that wheelchair to start with.
Yeah.
They put her in it, right. You see. And oh, they boy. Took the canes away from her, and then they gave the canes back to her. Now she's walking around in the lobby, and she's got a big smile on her face. I've been healed by Reverend Popoff. But he doesn't want to take the credit. He wants to give the credit to Jesus, because Jesus did the healing. And that's a big thing with Popoff. He always said, no, I didn't do it. So you can blame Jesus after. You don't blame him when it fails. And that I stepped up and I said, right on the video, I said, but wait a minute, you came in the wheelchair. And she said, oh, no, they gave me the wheelchair. Now, that's what we want, you see. But what happened to the canes? Well, they took the canes away from me. Yes, I see. And you sat in the wheelchair. And then you got up out of the wheelchair. She says, yes, praise Jesus.
Yep.
But you could have gotten up out of that wheelchair anyway, because you don't need a wheelchair. She said, well, that's true. And she hesitated a bit. And I said to her, but don't you think that's very deceptive? And she thought for a minute. She sort of looked heavenwards. And then she looked down and broke out in a smile. She said, well, yes, a little bit. But I still believe. Yep. I still believe. And she waved her finger at us and turned around with this big smile on her face and hobbled off on the canes.
Yep.
That's the kind of person that you're trying to convince that they've been swindled, they've been cheated to, they've been lied to, and they won't be convinced. They want to believe.
Yeah, you can't save them from themselves.
No, you can't save them.
And when something doesn't, later on, when it all goes back to normal, they go, I must have done something wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it's my fault because of my faith.
Because they constantly say, don't lose the healing. Don't lose the healing.
Speaking of healing, Jesus
has given it to you now.
Speaking of healing, didn't you have Popoff heal somebody of uterine cancer? A man?
Yeah, well, and I'm laughing now because it is it's in my book, The Faith Healers, as a matter of fact. I'm sure you'll all rush out and get a copy immediately.
Absolutely.
But in the book, we have a picture. He dressed up as a woman. I put the falsies in him. That was quite a delight, I can tell you. And he got into a wheelchair and the whole thing, and he was supposed to be healed of uterine cancer. Now, men don't get uterine cancer that I know of.
Not as far
at least not very often. Yeah.
How's my uterus doing?
Nobody I know.
You couldn't have nailed Popoff any better than you guys did. Like, you couldn't have discredited him any better.
That's true.
And, you know, we can clearly see he has a tremendous level of showmanship.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic charisma and everything. Mm-hmm. And the bottom line is it didn't do anything.
He's back.
Yeah.
See, Johnny Carson used to, after his retirement. Now, we wiped him out on the Johnny Carson show.
Yeah.
There's no question of it. It was an open and shut case.
Yep.
And as Carson said to me, along with Fred DeCordova, immediately after the show, we're at the desk while the audience is filing out after the show. And he's saying, well, I guess that's the end of Popoff. And I said, John, no, these are unsinkable rubber ducks. And he said, oh, after that, that's the end of him. And Fred DeCordova was doing a thumbs up at him and saying, yeah, that's the end of him. And I said, no, guys, that's not the end of him. And they what, Randy, come on. That's a nationwide show. There's no question of it. He's wiped out. But then, after Johnny's retirement, he'd call me about every 2 weeks regularly and then say, Randy, I just saw Popoff on television again. And he couldn't get over the idea that we hadn't put Popoff out of business. That was astonishing to John. But we wiped him out, Randy. No, we didn't, John. You can't sink an unsinkable rubber duck.
Well, the thing is, you're not putting him out of business as much as you're not convincing the people to not follow him.
Right.
Yeah.
Because that's his engine. That's what keeps him going.
The thing is with faith, it gets to a point where we go, okay, so he did one bad thing. but that doesn't discount right. everything, and doesn't discount, you know, that God does heal me, and doesn't discount that this guy has a relationship yep. with God in their minds.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, he did disappear for a little bit, but he's back, and now he doesn't, as far as I know, doesn't do the communication thing. He's got a great thing going for him now, which
water.
A lot of these
he's
guys do.
Water.
He's always done that. When I went with Randy, I would receive every week something like an outline of a foot to put in my shoes. Send me $50, $100. You'll get it back tenfold. And people are sending their life savings. The water is an old thing that goes way, way back.
Yeah.
But what he does now is he gets on TV and he has all these letters and he sits there and he says, okay, somebody has cancer. You know, I'm going to heal you now. And somebody has a headache, or somebody has this and somebody has that. And you can't discount that because somebody does.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Well, he's selling water from the Dead Sea of Galilee,
yes.
right?
Yep.
Okay. But we had a chemist in New York City, a fellow used to, he's the son of a friend of my father's who was a major analytical chemist there. It's iodized.
Mm-hmm.
That's very strange that the Sea of Galilee already has iodized salt in it.
Yeah.
It comes right out of a Morton's package.
Salt.
You know,
that's Morton's right.
salt. That's exactly where it comes from.
Yep.
But nobody seems to want to know that.
Well, thank you guys so much for spending time with us. And I liked having both of you on the show. You made our work easy. All we had to do was just sit back and let you talk with each other.
Right. It's been fun.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks, guys.
Great pleasure.
Thank you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my expert panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. I swept you guys last week at the live show. All of you plus Brian Dunning. Very proud.
Like that's difficult.
Let's see how you do this week. Ready?
Yeah.
Here we go. Item number one. Physicists have demonstrated the existence of a fourth property of electrons, the predicted electrical dipole moment. Item number two. Researchers have discovered a method of using video game processors to improve CT scans, reducing the resulting radiation dose by greater than a factor of 10. And item number three. Researchers find that a foreign accent reduces a person's perceived credibility.
Wow. Those are good.
Bob, go first.
Oh, okay. Let's see. We've got physicists demonstrating a fourth property of electrons. Yeah, that I'm kind of familiar with that. That's interesting. I can never understand how electrons, you know, could they have a dipole moment like a north-south pole, like a bar magnet when they're like point particles. That would be cool if they figured that out. Interesting. That's some interesting implications. Let's see, the second one here, video game processors. Yeah, I mean, why not? I mean, video game processors are on the forefront. I'm sure they could really help with their processing power reduce the amount of radiation dose. So sure, that makes sense by a factor of 10. Yeah, I could see that. That's just, with better algorithms and faster processing, you can get by with, I guess, less radiation, which, wow, what a boon that would be. And then we have to see that foreign accent reducing a person's perceived credibility. Yeah, I disagree with that. I would think it depends on the accent. Totally. I mean, some accents, like English accents, I think people pretty much universally would, depending on the type of English accent, would really improve someone's credibility, and other accents would dip it down. So yeah, I don't like that one. I'm going to say that the accent one is fiction.
All righty. Jay?
So physicists have demonstrated the existence of a fourth property of electrons. You're saying that they predicted this fourth property, and then now they've demonstrated that it does exist.
That's what it says.
And that fourth property would be the electrical dipole moment. Could you explain that to me?
Would you like to tell me what the first three properties are?
Absolutely.
Boardwalk, Park Place, I forget the last one.
Charge, spin, mass.
Yep.
Right.
So what's this last one? What does it mean?
Didn't I say it?
I don't listen to you when you talk, Bob.
Pay attention.
Okay. So then the second one over here, researchers, they discovered a method of using video game processors to improve CAT scans. Of course. That makes a lot of sense, and I don't think that is a far-fetched concept at all. And researchers find that a foreign accent reduces a person's perceived credibility. That also is absolutely true. Therefore, the only one that could be fake is the electrical dipole moment.
Okay. Rebecca?
I don't have much to add to what Bob said. I think that the fishiest one is the idea that an accent reduces a person's perceived credibility because, yeah, it depends on the accent. I could find an accent particularly credible. And, you know, also, it would depend on what country you're doing the study in, or what region even, because there might be some places that are more xenophobic than others, or other countries that really value the uniqueness of an accent. So I'm going to say that that one's BS, Steve.
Okay. Evan?
Oh, yeah. That was my first instinct was that the accent reducing a person's perceived credibility is nonsense. But very interesting about the video game processor used to improve CAT scans. And greater than a factor of 10. Now, Steve, I think typically you don't mess around too much with the factors as far as tweaking those to make something fiction where it's actually based on science. So based on that, I am leaning towards, and I'm going to go with the foreign accents as fiction.
Steve, can I add something?
No.
Okay.
If you must.
Well, in regards to the CAT scan one, it makes sense because of the specific functionality that video game processors have. Anyway, that's mm-hmm. what I think. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, you all agree, for whatever reason, that researchers have discovered a method of using video game processors to improve CT scans, reducing the resulting radiation dose by greater than a factor of 10. You all think that one is science. And that one is...
Yes.
Science.
Science.
Yay, video games.
So far, so good. Yeah, they actually are using a video game processor, a GPU. In fact, one made by NVIDIA. And it does, you're absolutely right, Jay. It has the exact kind of processing that is optimized for image processing. And it actually uses a different method than the ones that have been used by CT scans. So this is important because and this research was done primarily looking at the use of CT-guided radiation therapy for cancer or tumors, right? So you're basically using the CT scan to take a picture of a tumor and then using that picture to guide a beam of radiation. The problem is that the previous algorithm for constructing the image takes a really long time. So you have the patient sort of locked into one position and they can't move because otherwise the image becomes worthless, right, in terms of guiding the radiation therapy. But it could take over an hour, you know, in order to process that image. And therefore, in order to do it quickly enough, they have to use the image using more radiation, right? They got to take more pictures, which means more radiation, higher resolution. But with the new algorithm using a lot of parallel processing, they can put the picture together in about a minute to a minute and a half, and they can do it with far fewer and lower resolution images to start with. So they can reduce the radiation dose of the images, not the radiation dose of the therapy, to clarify. This is the amount of radiation you would get from taking the pictures. By a significant amount, you know, some accounts say greater than a factor of 10. They say possibly as much as 36 to 72 times less radiation.
Wow.
And they said the same method can apply to other applications of the CT scan as well. So, yeah, this could be – and it seems like a no-brainer. It's like they weren't using the same kind of processing to do this. But, again, you know, it kind of makes sense. But it's funny to think that the technology – that people are using to play games is actually more advanced than the technology in million-dollar medical scanners.
Yeah, but Steve, look at it this way. Over the past, 20, 30-plus years, the video game industry has been producing hardware that's been, generation to generation to generation, and there's a lot of functionality in there, a lot of custom things that they do to be able to pull off the kind of stuff that people want.
Yeah.
And it just took someone to think – well, why don't we, look into what these processors can do versus the other ones that are available to us?
Well, it's true. And, I have noticed that applications for medical purposes are just not as good as application software and computer applications for general use because the market's small.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's the bottom line.
So the drive isn't there. And it is interesting to think that gaming – desktop gaming is driving a lot of computer technology. I mean, most people don't need even a fraction of the processing power that modern computers have to do most of the things they do on the desktop. The thing that really uses up resources is gaming, right?
Yeah.
So that's what's driving the hardware to the point where it's now bleeding over into other applications,
which is awesome. Extrapolate that to a lot of things, Steve. I mean, screen resolution.
Yeah.
CPUs, sound cards, even communication speed from hard drive to processor, you know, to the motherboard, like all that stuff is pushed by the gaming industry.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting. Well, let's go on to number one. Jay, you thought this one was the fiction. The rest of you thought this one was science. And this one is, physicists have demonstrated the existence of a fourth property of electrons, the predicted electrical dipole moment. And this one is the fiction.
Jay, nicely done, Jay.
Oh, yeah. And you know why I didn't pick this accent?
It's the demonstrated, isn't it?
It hasn't been demonstrated yet, right? They're looking for it, but they haven't found it yet.
I didn't pick the accent one because when I hear someone speak in an accent, especially a higher crust British accent, I think that they sound
upper crust
way more intelligent. That adds credibility. When I hear Richard Dawkins talk, all I hear is, this guy is so intelligent, it's ridiculous.
But that, Jay, that goes against what the thing was.
Despite Jay's self-contradiction, let's go back to the dipole moment here. So this is pretty cool. And, Bob, you're right that, it is hard to imagine that the point, you know, particle of an electron would have a dipole, a separation of, like sort of the north and south pole of the electrical charge. But if there were an electrical dipole moment, that would potentially solve a lot of problems. And so physicists think that it may in fact exist, and they're looking for it. Bob, they specifically mentioned that this may also provide a solution to the symmetry problem of why does the universe exist, right? Why is there this residue of matter? Why didn't all the matter get destroyed by all the antimatter? And this would potentially be one thing that would potentially explain why there was an excess of matter after the Big Bang.
Awesome.
But Bob, these physicists are hopeful that in the near future they will demonstrate the electric dipole moment. It's just really small and hard to detect. They're developing the equipment now that they think will be sensitive enough to detect it. So maybe in a few years, they'll have discovered it, but not yet.
I wish I keyed in on that one.
Which means that researchers find that a foreign accent reduces a person's perceived credibility is science. But make a reasonable point. You do make a reasonable point that it certainly depends upon the accent. But what they found,
we make a devastating point.
I would say reasonable.
Why weren't we on the peer review for this? That's what
I'm asking. So they did find that that the type of accent did matter. But essentially, what they found was that the more difficult the accent was to understand, the lower the perceived credibility. And the thinking is that the listener assumes that the information is less trustworthy because they have a harder time understanding it. And they tried to control for other variables like, you know, prejudice or xenophobia in the protocol, for example, they told the listeners that the information was being given to the speaker. It wasn't based upon the speaker's own knowledge. But then they were asked to rate the truthfulness of what the speaker said, and the thicker an accent they had, the lower their ranking of their truthfulness.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. You know, it's about accents. You know, I always like to talk about accents.
Yeah, we've talked about that once or twice on the show. Nobody's ever given us any grief for that.
Never.
No, people love accent discussions.
Man, I really kicked ass tonight.
Jay, the winner. Good job.
I got lucky.
You know what, Jay? As a reward for that, you get to say the quote of the week.
Oh, cool. Wow. Okay.
Lucky bastard.
Wait a second. I just got to pinch myself. I mean, last week, Steve had a clean sweep.
Yep.
Today, Jay's the only winner. I mean, I got to be dreaming.
It's bizarre world. The world's upside down. What's going on?
Get used to it.
Get used to it.
We're through the looking glass, people. All right, go ahead, Jay.
This was a quote sent in by a listener named Mitchell Hogg. I'd like to thank Mitchell. This quote is from a comedian who I love named Mitch Hedberg. I don't know if any of you guys know who he is.
Might have heard of him.
I know you know
him. I might adore
him. He's great. You should look him up if you don't know who he is. He had a really, really cool comedic style. So anyway, Mitch said, I think Bigfoot is blurry. That's the problem. It's not the photographer's fault. Bigfoot is blurry. And that's extra scary to me because there's a large, out-of-focus monster roaming the countryside. Run. He's fuzzy. Get out of here. Mitch Hedberg.
Bigfoot himself is out of focus.
Yeah. Your comedic timing was Hedbergian.
Well, I did mimic him a little bit. There's no other way to say that sentence, Rebecca.
In a way, it's true. Ghosts are wispy and UFOs are streaky and Bigfoots are fuzzy.
Yeah, I guess that's one explanation.
Loch Ness monsters are
humpy.
Are log shaped
humpy?
Yeah,
are humpy.
Are carved pieces of wood.
So, you guys want to hear a weird thing? I thought for a very long time. You know the famous picture of the Loch Ness monster,
the surgeon's photo.
Yeah,
yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Now that's supposed to be a picture of a very long neck with a head, right?
That's one interpretation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I always looked at it. Like it was more like an elephant's trunk. That's when I was younger. That's what I thought that was.
Well, that was a theory for quite a while because there was like a circus in town when that was shot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that particular theory has been debunked. Or
well,
not,
I mean, the guy confessed on his deathbed. I took the photo. It's a fake. It's a model. Mm. So any other theory has, I guess, by definition, been debunked, right?
Yeah, somebody paid him to lie, though.
That's right. It's a conspiracy.
Deathbed.
On his deathbed.
Convictions. We need some more Doug and Daves who can, you know, when they still have all their faculties, can actually get up and tell us and show us what exactly.
Have the stones to confess before you're on your deathbed.
Right? Come on. Come on, all you hoaxers. Get with it.
Yeah, we need a confession for the Patterson film. We need a confession for... I want... you know who? If I could force one person to totally confess everything...
Jesus.
Zabruder.
Zabruder.
Well, you're not going to get a confession, say, from the people who created chiropractic or homeopathy because they believe it. There's nothing to confess. They actually believe it.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about a confession of a hoax.
Hoagland?
No, I think he's a nutcase.
No.
Sylvia Brown.
Yeah.
That'd be a good one.
There you go.
I don't think that'd have any impact. I'd want it to actually be something that people get a benefit from, a real like health benefit from not believing it anymore.
I would like Billy Meyer to confess to the whole 20-30 year UFO hoax that he's been carrying off.
That'd be nice, but it wouldn't be epic. But it would be nice.
What would be the most epic confession? I think Sylvia Brown, if she came out and said, "Listen, you people are dumb. You're marks." I've been making money off of idiots for years, and now I'm going to retire. Kevin Trudeau would be another good one, you know, although he might face some jail time if he actually did that.
Oops.
But you know what? If they haven't thrown him in jail yet, I don't think there's a goddamn thing he can do to actually get into jail.
Maybe. Well, thanks for a good show, everyone.
Oh, wait. I have an announcement.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm going to be at Glasgow Skeptics in the Pub on Monday, the 26th of July. And you can figure out where and all that stuff at glasgow.skepticsinthepub.org.
Oh, yeah. And you guys can hear me. I joined the guys from Reality Check at TAM briefly for about a half an hour on their last show. So if you want to hear that, we had a good time talking about the gambling situation. It was a fun time.
Gambling situation.
Yeah, like, you know, we just talked about...
your gambling problem?
Yes, we did. We talked about my gambling problem and my drinking problem.
Well, don't steal the thunder. Just listen to Reality Check.
Okay.
Yeah.
My polite way of telling you to shut up. All right.
Shut up.
Thanks for joining me again this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you,
Shirley.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.